Welcome to Nature Bats Last on the Progressive Radio Network. It's NBL on PRN.FM, this December 16th, 2014 edition of Nature Bats Last, like future episodes, is pre-recorded. As a result, there's no chance to take your questions on the air. Our theme is provided as a gift with our thanks by Afrozen, and you can find more of his work on SoundCloud.com. Background music for a couple of our regular segments, including the next one, will be provided by 17-year-old Scottish teenager Rianne Farragan. On tonight's show, we cover torture, patriarchy, and its impact on climate change, a new segment we call Real or Fake News. We hear from Corey Morningstar in Breaking Hopium, our interview with Paul Beckwith later on, a new Doomer of the Week, and of course, Guy's climate update. So why don't we get started?
Tonight's first segment highlights news beyond the echo chamber of the mainstream. We'll mention two stories. Mike, what do you have to start us off?
My story comes from Interpress Service News Agency, and it's by Susan McDade, and the headline reads, "Will Women Bear the Brunt of Climate Change and Its Inequalities?" Among all the impacts of climate change, from rising sea levels to landslides and flooding, there is one that does not get the attention it deserves, an exacerbation of inequalities, particularly for women. Especially in poor countries, women's lives are often directly dependent on the natural environment. Women bear the responsibility for supplying water, firewood, for cooking and heating, as well as growing food. Drought, uncertain rainfall, and deforestation make these tasks more time-consuming and arduous, threaten women's livelihoods, and deprive them of time to learn skills, earn money, and participate in community life. Women's knowledge and experience can make natural resource management and climate change adaptation and mitigation strategies at all levels more successful. To see this in action, just look to the Ecuadorian Amazon, where the Huarani Women Association is promoting organic cocoa cultivation as a wildlife protection measure. With support from the UN Development Program, the Women's Association is managing its land collectively and working towards zero deforestation, the protection of vulnerable wildlife species, as well as the production of certified organic chocolate. In the process, the women are building the resilience of their community by investing revenues from the cocoa business into local education, health, and infrastructure projects, and successfully steering the local economy away from clear-cutting and unregulated bushmeat. Empowered women are one of the most effective ways to respond to climate change. The success of climate change actions depend on elevating women's voices, making sure their experiences and views are heard at the decision-making tables, and supporting them to become leaders in climate adaptation. This article is another example, really, of the connection between patriarchy and climate change. Women's voices have been ignored or shut down in a dominant culture, and the cost is near-term human extinction via climate change. Guy, what do you have?
Thanks, Mike. From Common Dreams on Wednesday, December 10th, comes a story headlined, "Obama, American Exceptional, So We Don't Prosecute Torturers." As I've come to expect from the current liar-in-chief and promoter of torture, Obama hides behind American exceptionalism. I'll quote from the first few paragraphs of the article, written by John Quayle, staff writer for Common Dreams. In his first official remarks following Tuesday's release of the Senate Intelligence Committee's report on the torture program conducted by the CIA during the presidency of George W. Bush, President Barack Obama on Tuesday night indicated that the abuses detailed in the report conducted in the name of the American people, described as horrific, ruthless, and much more brutal than previously thought, should not be followed by further inquiries or prosecutions, as many have long urged. In his remarks, Obama acknowledged that no nation is perfect, but argued that one of the strengths that make America exceptional is our willingness to openly confront our past, face our imperfections, make changes, and do better. Backed by his interpretation of American exceptionalism, Obama suggested that the release of the report, which his administration fought tirelessly to restrict, was all that was necessary in order for the nation to move forward. Rather than another reason to refight old arguments, Obama continued, I hope that today's report can help us leave these techniques where they belong, in the past. Legal experts and human rights advocates, however, have taken a decidedly different approach to the report, as many renewed a simple message in the wake of Tuesday's release saying, if gross crimes were committed, prosecutors should be assigned and the criminals should be tried and punished. In other words, Obama continues the long-trodden path of American politicians in trying to hide the past, hence the present, from the citizenry. Meanwhile, Amnesty International's Eric Guevara provides an accurate assessment in two sentences. Quote, this is a wake-up call to the USA. They must disclose the full truth about the human rights violations, hold perpetrators accountable, and ensure justice for the victims. This is not a policy nicety. It is a requirement under international law, end quote. I appreciate the comment about international law, but Ms. Guevara incorrectly assumes the USA and its politicians are interested in following international law. It's a pleasant thought, albeit stunningly naive. I'm reminded of a line from 19th-century Danish philosopher and social critic Søren Kierkegaard, often considered the original existential philosopher. Quote, there are two ways to be fooled. One is to believe in what isn't true. The other is to refuse to accept what is true, end quote. Most Americans are being fooled both ways. Chained to their attachments and blinded by their entitlements, they refuse to accept reality. There are advantages to delusion, as typified by most Americans. But reality has its advantages, too. Our next segment is called Real or Fake News. In it, we provide a headline, and you guess whether it's from the mainstream media or an organization such as The Onion. Today's headline from December 9th, Cheney calls for international ban on torture reports. I'll run that by you again just to make sure you have time to process it. Cheney calls for international ban on torture reports. And wait for it. The report is from the Borowitz report in The New Yorker. In other words, it's fake news. But you could have fooled me. As regular listeners know by now, we offer brief opinion pieces each week. In Breaking Hopium, we hear from radical perspectives that cut to the root of an issue. This year, we get a dose of Breaking Hopium from writer and activist Corey Morningstar. I interviewed Corey for this show back on September 30th of this year. In today's show, Corey comments on the just-completed Conference of Parties 20 in Lima, Peru. In so doing, she connects white privilege with abrupt climate change.
Sometimes it can be hard to breathe when you're drowning in bullshit. 2 degrees as a safe limit is bullshit. The so-called carbon bubble is bullshit. The carbon budget is bullshit. They all have a common denominator. All language crafted by the elite, all widely dispersed through the echo chambers of corporate media and so-called progressive media in tandem with the nonprofit industrial complex and state, they all serve the illusion we can keep consuming, keep burning, keep growing, keep killing, as per usual. The 1% who created 50% of the global greenhouse gas emissions, the 1% being anyone who can afford to get on a plane, swallows the illusions whole and asks for seconds. Lies that can negate and even sequester uncomfortable truths seem capable of overriding all logic in most people, especially those of privilege, those atop the capitalist system who benefit the most from the most inhumane oppression of others and unprecedented destruction of our shared Earth. To my disappointment, a most recent example can be found in the declaration delivered during the COP20 conference in Lima, Peru, by the Arctic Methane Emergency Group, known by the acronym AMEG, where it advocates for geoengineering the planet. In the declaration's summation, it reads that, quote, "The objective should be achievable without any revolution or radical change in the way we live. In fact, the solutions to the challenges are not only affordable, but can be a great economic benefit in the long run," unquote. That's right. No radical changes in the way we live, no shift in current power structures. I'm sure this will be a relief to those enslaved at the bottom rung of the capitalist system. I've never been sold on the idea of geoengineering for the simple reason that collectively we continue to demonstrate we have no intention of pursuing profound and necessary changes. All one has to do to see this is true is look at Black Friday, quote-unquote Black Friday, the biggest shopping day of the year after the Thanksgiving celebration in the U.S. that is spreading the globe like a virus. Cyber Monday is online version that allows customers to stay at home while continuing to gorge themselves on consumerism, and the new Giving Tuesday, where you toss some cash to an NGO. For just $5 on Tuesday, you can erase your gluttonous behavior Friday and Monday. Sounds a lot like church. Although EMEG is probably right that, quote, "reductions alone have no chance preventing catastrophes arising from Arctic meltdown, there is no realistic alternative," unquote, I'm still left wondering, who the fuck do we think we are? Privilege and whiteness has a way of invoking blindness. Those oppressed by today's industrialized global capitalist system are made to be invisible. The Earth being savagely raped and pillaged is indiscernible. We don't plan to stop. We only want more. More infrastructure, more growth, more stuff, more everything. Maybe nature is simply saving us from ourselves, and also that which remains undestroyed as yet from us. The race to save humans, privileged humans at least, without first addressing our militarism nightmare, our apathy toward impoverished people by way of our collective acceptance of the suicidal capitalist economic system, the deadly endless growth dogma, a necessary transition to a plant-based diet, the appalling way we treat sentient beings, without first cutting our consumption in half, all of this and more leads me to think out loud. If we are not going to first address, tackle, and solve such vital issues, are we really a species worthy of saving?
Well, that gets right to the heart. Corey, thank you for that. This week we interview climate scientist Paul Beckwith. Paul is a doctoral candidate in the Department of Geography at the University of Ottawa, where he works in the Laboratory for Paleoclimatology and Climatology. He's also a part-time professor at the same institution. Paul is an authority on the historic and ongoing release of methane from the Arctic Ocean, and you can follow his extensive work on his YouTube channel. He's also active with other social media, including Facebook, Tumblr, Google+, and Twitter. Paul holds a bachelor's degree in engineering physics and a master of science in physics, specializing in laser optics. Paul has just returned from Lima, Peru, where he represented Ghana at the United Nations Conference of Parties 20th meeting, otherwise known as COP20. Thanks for joining us on NaturePath Labs, Paul Beckwith.
Hi, Guy. Thank you for having me.
Well, it's certainly our pleasure. What's the Ghana connection for COP20, and how did that come about?
Well, it was basically it's a funny story. There's this gentleman, Stuart Scott, who has been sort of following the AMEG email group for a while. And he sent out a nasty sort of email to everybody in the group saying, you guys can email all you want, but until you actually go out and do something, you're not going to get much traction. So I immediately responded with a one-liner and said, sure, get me down there, pay for my trip, and I'll gladly join you. We don't all have resources to do that. So I didn't hear, after sending that email, I didn't hear anything for about 3 or 4 days. And then I got an email saying, okay, we'd like you to come down and and we'll cover your air miles. We'll cover your flight by air miles. I said, sure, okay, I'm there. So it was through the same gentleman. He's been to many, many COPs, and he knows a lot of people in the IPCC and the system, as well as people in religious organizations. And one of them happens to be an NGO in Ghana, and they accredited us, myself and John Neeson, and some other people. And so I spent a couple weeks in Lima attending this conference.
Well, that's wonderful. That's incredible generosity. We'd like a few details on your COP20 experience and subsequent censorship, at least in the short term, by the United Nations of videos produced by AMEC. Some have speculated that AMEC... Can you comment on that?
Yeah. I was involved myself in four different press conferences. It was on Wednesday, December 3rd, Thursday, the Friday, and the Saturday, so all the first week. The first one was basically a number of scientists, including myself, and a number of religious leaders from different denominations talking about that. Climate change is being an interesting issue where scientists and religious leaders and people were quite a bit on the same page in terms of, you know, saying it's a serious problem that needs to be addressed. And then John Neeson was talking about AMEG on the Thursday. I think that was at 12:30. And then on the Friday, I spoke for about 20 minutes on the climate system. So basically how, you know, the greenhouse gases is causing very unequal warming. The 2 degree threshold temperature that the IPCC bases everything on isn't really the right metric to look at. You really need to look at the temperature difference between the equator and the North Pole, which is decreasing rapidly as the Arctic is warming rapidly, distorting the jet streams, causing extreme weather events, and also warming the oceans and air so that the methane is starting to come out from the permafrost and sediments quickly. So the press conference, we're all trying to educate people on the urgency of the problem.
Some have speculated that AMEC violated a couple of taboos, use of the word geoengineering and pointing out the conservatism of the IPCC. Do you think that had anything to do with the at least short-term censorship? And are the videos back now?
From what I understand, all of the videos are there. So if people just Google the press conference room 2 COP20 the noon to the noon time press conferences on those days, those videos, those half-hour videos of each press conference can be seen. There was an understanding between myself and John Neeson and Stuart Scott that we would not actually talk about geoengineering per se, that we would not use the term geoengineering because that's sort of a hot button term to be used, and this was not the anything to do with the IPCC or the COP20 people. What it was this gentleman Stuart who's got a good relationship with the IPCC, and one of his stipulations was that when we talked about the flaws in the process of the IPCC and not really, you know, harp on, not slam them, obviously, at their own conference, because that was pretty pointless to do that. It wouldn't get traction. You know, it's sort of water under the bridge. So this is perfectly acceptable to me. I mean, I can talk about what we need to do in terms of solar radiation management and carbon dioxide removal, you know, and what different ideas there are for that. Yeah, that's perfectly fine with me. But John Neeson is a bit more stubborn and refused to sort of play by the rules. So he was cautioned about it, and he went and started talking about geoengineering and slamming the IPCC a bit. So Stuart had the video pulled, but it was sort of a momentary thing, and it was just an annoyance of John. I mean, John, we had an agreement with him, and John basically broke the agreement, so he annoyed probably me even more so than Stuart. So it was just a bit of, it's like herding cats, I guess. I mean, you know, you get there, you have people very passionate about the issues, and, you try to, set ground rules beforehand of how you're going to run a press conference, and then right during the conference, if it's violated by Mr. Nissan, then it annoys the other people that he's just been talking with just moments before the press conference, for example. So there's a bit of that in there, but it wasn't really, in my view, what John was saying, is it really going to affect things? Are there going to be high-level IPCC people seeing that particular press conference? I highly doubt it, but, Stuart was sensitive to it. He was doing the organizing for it, so I was very happy to abide by his rules. But John Nissan, on the other hand, was his own, doing his own thing, basically. But I think the conference was very, it was very good for AMEG. I mean, we were able to get our message across, on a number of different press conferences.
Yes, I certainly saw those, and I can identify with the herding cats analogy. Anytime you get a bunch of people together who are brilliant and passionate, and they have something they want to say, it's going to be difficult to rein them in.
Yes, exactly.
According to Tim Garrett's published research, in which he acknowledges civilization as a heat engine, the only way to prevent runaway climate change is to terminate civilization. Never mind that, according to your work on Arctic Ocean methane, it's evidently too late for that. Why do you suppose aren't more climate scientists promoting the collapse of civilization based on the published evidence?
Well, I guess, to use the term the collapse of civilization or to use the term, human extinction, I mean, those are very, broad terms, right? Like, I would put out a scenario that, let's say we get a collapse of half the population or half the civilization, then that will surely be a very strong negative feedback or non-reinforcing feedback. There'll be a lot fewer people on the planet, a lot fewer mouths to feed, and then perhaps, I don't see that we actually know that entire civilization will collapse. We definitely have deep structural problems. I mean, definitely. But I'm of the view that we need to slash emissions. So this is this was an encouraging thing from COP20 because there were many, many voices from many different countries coming out and actually saying we have to decarbonize the economy completely. Now their time frame is much longer than any of us that follow climate change rapidity closely would want. They were talking more like the 2040, 2050 sort of time frame. But this is a kind of a new thing, which I haven't really heard. The countries are actually coming out, and it's not just, it's not just the small island countries that are about to vanish under the waves. The agreement between China and the U.S. prior to the conference was encouraging, and there are signs that India might come on board with those. But the AMEG position, as you well know, is that this is simply not good enough and that we need to look at solar radiation management and carbon dioxide removal methods to buy us time to slash these emissions. And I think from a systems point of view, if we were able to cool the Arctic, then that would pretty much bring us back to a situation that we had before in terms of more predictable jet stream patterns and weather patterns. That's a big debate in the science, right, whether that's possible or not. But I think from a high-level systems point of view, the disruptions that we're having in extreme weather events, flooding, torrential rains, droughts, is directly a result of the fracturing and breakdown of the jet stream, which is directly a result of the warming Arctic.
Right. And as I'm sure you know, geoengineering has been discussed by authors of at least 5 Referee Journal articles since early December 2013. A summary of those papers is provided in the February 25th, 2014 issue of Nature Communications, and I'm going to quote from it. Current schemes are likely to either be relatively useless or actually make things worse. In other words, to quote Truth Out from April of this year, geoengineering is, quote, fantasy technology. It looks like there's quite a bit of evidence suggesting that geoengineering could actually make things worse if it's attempted at scale. Now, that aside, there's considerable effort to move forward within the next couple of years in various strategies of geoengineering.
Right.
So, it seems like we're in a damned if you do, damned if you don't sort of scenario.
Well, again, if I can make a comment on that. I mean, geoengineering is a very broad term. So, break it up into solar radiation management, and that's where you're actually trying to cut the sunlight coming to the planet, either by, for example, sulfur in the stratosphere or marine cloud, like salt spray, in the marine boundary layer in the first 1.5 kilometers or something to create low-level clouds to cool. I mean, that's one thing. But, carbon dioxide removal is part of geoengineering. And part of carbon dioxide removal is such things as, for example, going to areas that were deforested and planting huge numbers of trees and forests with the intention of pulling CO2 out of the atmosphere. So that's geoengineering, right? I mean, that's under the broad umbrella called geoengineering, if you like. Another idea is to pyrolyze organic matter so it won't decompose into either CO2 or methane, whether, in the absence or presence of oxygen, but to create this biochar and then bury it in the soils to increase the productivity of soils, but also to store carbon for long periods of time. So this is all this also falls under geoengineering, right? I mean, geoengineering, the term itself, is just I think it should be broken up into the specific ideas, because I don't think you can lump all of those processes in the same basket.
Sure. So let's talk about solar radiation management for a minute. There's been a couple of papers. One in the January 8th issue of Environmental Research Letters, quote, attempts to reverse the impacts of global warming by injecting reflective particles into the stratosphere could make matters worse. And then another paper from February 17th, 2014 issue of the same journal, Environmental Research Letters, quote, risk of abrupt and dangerous warming is inherent to the large-scale implementation of solar radiation management. So, that's an idea that has been discussed in the journal literature and I think found wanting. I haven't seen any refereed journal articles in favor or point out that there would be advantages of SRM.
Yeah. So speaking of SRM, we know when there's a volcano that injects sulfur dioxide into the stratosphere. So if the volcano is powerful enough to reach up to the stratosphere, then, for example, Pinatubo, then that will cool the Earth by about half a degree for, a year or two. So we know that sulfur dioxide in the stratosphere would do that. Now, I guess you have to weigh the risk. Like, in order to assess whether it's a good thing to try that or not, you have to look at the full question. And the full question is, what happens with the planet if we don't do that versus what happens if we do that? Nobody's saying that doing it is risk-free, but the argument, I haven't seen a argument which weighs what happens if we don't do it and if the Arctic sea ice goes, and therefore the Arctic warming accelerates rapidly, and therefore the jet streams become much, much worse and fractured, and extreme weather events increase in frequency, amplitude, duration, and go to different regions, you know, by an order of magnitude at a factor of 10 or 20 or 30 times worse than what they are now. You know, because we really need to look at that, you know, if we don't do anything, what do we have versus the risks if we do something? So, you know, I mean, what you've been talking about is the risks of if we do something. And we really need, you know, these papers, none of these papers discuss the risks of what happens if we don't do anything, if we just continue the way we're going. So, I mean, we've only had a 0.85 degree global average temperature rise since the Industrial Revolution, and already we're seeing complete disruptions of the jet streams and a complete ramping up of extreme weather events that, you know, take out a city here like Calgary for $6 billion, Toronto for $1 billion, take out the state of Colorado, you know, flood it, flood three quarters of Pakistan and cause massive heat waves in Moscow. And, you know, these weather extremes, imagine these going, you know, much, much worse. Imagine them happening 10 times or 20 times more often. And then those are the costs that we can have by not doing anything. So I think it certainly is prudent to examine all of the options. You know, certainly not talk about geoengineering. But the geoengineering term itself has been poisoned completely, because you have this entire group of people who talk about chemtrails and they believe we're geoengineering already and it's not doing anything and it's messing up, you know, putting chemicals in the air and so on. So the whole term geoengineering, in my view, is completely poisoned. And it's important to talk about the specific things. Like, who can be arguing that putting more trees on the planet to replace the deforestation that has happened is a bad thing? And yet, that falls under the umbrella of this geoengineering word, right? So,
of course, I couldn't agree more with that. We need to be more specific with our language.
Yeah.
This is Nature by Flash on the Progressive Radio Network. Today we're joined by climate scientist Paul Beckwith from the University of Ottawa. Paul, you led me right down the road where I wanted to go with you, and that's how bad things could possibly get when the Arctic ice is gone and the British Parliament suggested it would be gone as early as next year. As you know, the Naval Postgraduate School of the United States, a study conducted there indicates 2016, plus or minus a few years. What's your worst-case scenario? How rapidly could temperatures rise? How rapidly, in the wake of an inability to cool the Arctic, could we see habitat for our species and many others going away? So how rapidly could global temperature rise, and over what time frame?
Yeah, well, I guess I'll paint a quick picture of the way I see things developing, you know, with us just continuing as usual. Let's say that the Arctic Ocean has a blue ocean event in, say, 2018. And by such an event, that would be under 1 million square kilometers of sea ice in September, say 2018. Now, when you the amount of energy that melts 1 kilogram of ice into 1 kilogram of water at 0 degrees Celsius, if you take that same amount of energy and apply it to the water, it raises that temperature 80 degrees. So basically, with a blue ocean event, say in 2018, within two or three years, that the ocean would be open for 2 or 3 months of the year, as opposed to maybe just a few weeks in September. And by within about a decade or so of the initial blue ocean event, it's very conceivable that the ocean the Arctic Ocean could be ice free year round. And this is because of all these rapidly cascading feedback effects, including perhaps even methane, but maybe it may be not being due primarily to methane. I mean, I see the waviness of the jet streams right now, the massive waviness, the so-called polar vortex that the media talks about. And what people don't realize is, you know, it's quite obvious when you get a very large crest of a wave, you know, in the jet stream, that a lot of heat is traveling to the Arctic, contributing to the warming in the crest of the wave. But in the trough of the wave, you get a tremendous amount of cold air from the Arctic coming southward. And that, in effect, is another great warming of the Arctic. So the wavier the jet stream gets, the more the heat is distributed amongst the latitudes. So there's an equalization of temperature with latitude from this feedback effect. And that's what can really drive us into, you know, a different regime, if you like. So I believe that we're in an early stage of abrupt climate change where we're actually moving to, you know, a much warmer Arctic, and that will affect, of course, global, not just the Northern Hemisphere weather patterns, but because the Arctic is warming so much by itself from the increased solar absorption, shortwave radiation from the sun being absorbed in the Arctic's darkening. The average reflectivity of the entire Arctic region is about 48%, and it was 52% about 30 years ago. So the whole region's darkening. So there's less heat going from the equator to the Arctic, so there's more heat going southward. And that causes increases the temperature gradient with Antarctica, increases the polar vortex, the circumpolar currents and atmospheric winds. And that does directly cause an increase in sea ice in Antarctica. So, you know, I try to look at the whole system and see how it's behaving. So how it will affect us is that, yeah, these weather extremes will get much worse, and we're going to have trouble feeding our present population, let alone feeding the extra 220,000 odd people that are, you know, new mouths that are we require feeding each morning. Right, with the present population growth rate. So yeah, we're in deep trouble here, and it's coming to a crux very quickly, dependent on the sea ice loss. I mean, if there's negative feedbacks that we're missing that cause the exponential downward trend in sea ice to somehow flatten out, you know, we may have a bit more time. So given these scenarios, this is why AMEG is so sort of eager to try to get the message out to people that we have to slash emissions, but it's not enough. We have to cool the Arctic. Otherwise, the extreme weather events that we see now are just the tip of the iceberg. And if you go by the past changes in temperature, the Earth temperature has changed 5 or 6 degrees in a decade or two, the global average temperature. So it's quite conceivable that we could have this 5 or 6 degree temperature change within a decade or two. So say by, you know, 2030, 2035. Now, that's not so far off what other people are now saying. Like the International Energy Agency has given a number of 3 or 4 degrees by 2050, right? And that's only about 35 years off. So there is becoming a convergence of people.
I think they go as far as to say business as usual could take as high as 60 by 2050.
Right. So we should be happy, Guy, because you and I, we're getting lots of people coming around to our way of thinking. It's just taking them a while.
Right. I'm not really happy that it looks like things are headed down that dire path.
but the way I look at this is, I've just given this scenario. Think of me as A Christmas Carol. Ebenezer Scrooge is visited by the ghost of the future that can be, right? So I'm the ghost of the future that can be, as you are. You know, we're telling people where we're heading, given, you know, that we continue what we're doing. But of course, you know, the next morning, Christmas morning, Ebenezer Scrooge, you know, completely changed. He became very nice. He went out and bought a turkey for the little kid and so on and so forth, right? So I'm expecting that, or hoping, maybe it's not a valid hope, that the public and society can actually have this tipping point in human behavior and see, yeah, this is a huge problem that we have to address.
Yeah.
Right?
I mean, if Ebenezer can get it, then that certainly leaves the door open for everybody, doesn't it?
Yeah, so I don't know, but it's certainly looking, I mean, just recently the WWF had this report. I mean, we're basically well into a mass extinction on the planet, and we've lost, you know, 50% of wildlife, basically, you know, in the last 40 years. Yeah, 30 or 40 years. Yeah. So, I mean, you know, can we continue to be this, you know, it's very hard to understand how we've let things go so badly, you know, but I mean, it doesn't mean that we have to continue doing this. So there are glimmers of hope. But you know, the way the IPCC is structured, they're just, you know, if climate change was happening slowly on a linear fashion, then yeah, this organization could deal with it. But, you know, with the rapidity of these changes, we need, you know, the system needs to be revamped. The present system is completely inadequate for addressing the rapid changes that we're seeing now that are occurring.
Oh, yes. By the time a report comes out, it's got 7 to 10 year old information in it. I mean, that's no way to respond to an emergency, which is clearly where we are with climate
change. I mean, they do, you know, I mean, they're very cautious. I mean, they say that, you know, a scientist will go and research for a year, then it might take a year to get the paper published, and then it has to be out in the public domain as a peer-reviewed paper for about 2 years before it's considered to go into an IPCC report. And, of course, if those reports are only coming out every 7 years, then, you know, like, come on, this is ridiculous. I mean, we need to start addressing. We need to have, like, the top scientists in different, you know, the top ice people, the top methane people. We need to have these online groups that is somehow organized on a global basis so that, you know, and then groups that tie all of connect all the dots together and are connected to policy people. I mean, we need to, you know, I mean, it's not like we're just acting really dumb on this issue, you know, collectively. So, you know, I think, you know, what you're doing and what I'm doing, a lot of it is just trying to, you know, get this message out of how bad things will be if we just continue on our present path and do nothing. I mean, even if we even if we knew that doing anything was futile, I mean, you tend to think maybe that more than I do, then that doesn't mean that we don't need to, we don't, as humans having hope, it doesn't mean that we don't want to try to actually do something, take action, right? But
I say frequently, if you're damned if you do and damned if you don't, then do. And
yeah,
what better measure of our character than to join the battle that cannot possibly be won? And we don't know, you know, what the future holds with great certainty. And
yeah,
so let's join the battle, sort of independent upon the outcome or without attachment to the outcome. Okay, another question. The United Nations Advisory Group on Greenhouse Gases in October 1990 pointed out, quote, beyond 1 degree C may elicit rapid, unpredictable, and nonlinear responses that could lead to extensive ecosystem damage, end quote. In other words, was one degree C was recognized a long time ago as the absolute upper limit. But as David Spratt points out in his video presentation from late October 2014, just about 6 weeks ago, half a degree C was a more reasonable target. Now, we passed that point a long time ago. And you've talked about cooling the Arctic. Can you talk about some of the specific strategies, some of the specific steps that we might take now in addition to decarbonizing, you know, the sort of emergency, let's go at it, let's try to cool the Arctic? What kind of specific steps can we take in light of the fact that we're well beyond half a degree temperature rise and that the Arctic...
Yes. Yeah, no, it's interesting. There's been some reports about where that 2 degree number today came from, and yeah, I mean, how it was 1 degree and it's been sliding upwards, and you know, we've had the 0.85 degrees, you know, of which 0.6 of which is in the last 30 or 40 years, and you know, the climate system seems to be destabilizing now. So, so specific steps that we can do. It depends on, like, if we have absolutely no time. I mean, if we're going to lose the Arctic sea ice in a year or two, And, you know, if you believe some of the radiation balance models, that will be enough to spiral us into you know, a much, a very, very large and quick warming of the Arctic. I mean, just looking at the difference between latent heat and sensible heat of water and ice, there's really the only thing we can try to do is to inject sulfur dioxide in the atmosphere in the Arctic in the summer to try to cool it down, or at least even if you do it at slightly lower latitudes in the Arctic to cool, say, water flows that move up into the Arctic, maybe that can have some effect. The amounts of sulfur we'd be talking about, sulfur dioxide, are minuscule compared to what we pump out of smokestacks right now. In fact, the Microsoft guy, Mirholder, one of the Microsoft guys was saying, yeah, just if we could tie a big hose to the top of smokestack so that we can, instead of blowing the stuff a couple hundred meters up from power plants, the sulfur and so on, we blow it up into the stratosphere. I mean, is that geoengineering? Like, we call it geoengineering if we try to modify something that we've been doing for years, right? Like I don't understand that distinction, right? Because the moment humans cut down a tree or planted a crop, you know, one could argue that that's all geoengineering, right? You know, but it's not.
Yes, I would go a step further and say that we've been geoengineering since we fired up the first internal combustion engine or cut down the first tree, and that we geoengineer every day with every time we flip a light switch.
Yeah. I mean, yes, exactly. Although the definition of geoengineering is supposed to be it's something that you're doing intentionally, right? Like, that's the idea of engineering, that you actually have a design and a plan and you want to solve a problem, right? So, but inadvertently, yes, we've been doing all that all along. So, you know, the idea of getting up in arms about trying to actually do something smart just doesn't seem to, you know, make sense. But so, you know, so that would be probably the quickest method. And we know from volcanoes how they behave, how Pinatubo behaved, and so on, the effect on the, you know, a lot of what would happen on to the planet, you know, how the cooling would happen, how it's distributed and stuff. We know that. We've got lots of data from volcanoes. You know, not a lot of good satellite data. I mean, Pinatubo in 91 was very well studied because we had all the satellites in place and the sensors from about the late 70s, right? So we could actually measure, you know, particle distributions and temperature distributions and winds and so on and ocean temperatures from, you know, very well from the Pinatubo event. Of course, Mount St. Helens blew sideways and didn't get stuff up into the stratosphere, so it didn't affect the climate. So we do know quite a bit about that. Now, one of the geoengineers, you might get him on the program at some point, or, you know, he's an engineer. He's at Stephen Salter at Edinburgh University, because he's the one who's talking about these marine cloud brightening methods, using just taking salt water, pumping it up, and spraying it out of nozzles about a kilometer or a kilometer and a half above the ocean, creating these low-level clouds, causing cooling of the water that then enters the Arctic. So he's been talking about this and studying this for years. So, you know, how is this any different from making snow on a ski hill, right? I mean, we use high-pressure pumps. We pump water through nozzles, and we make snow on a ski hill. How many people have objected to ski hills making snow, right?
Well, there are a few indigenous people who think those areas are sacred. They're about the only ones. Yeah. Everybody else seems to think it's a great idea.
Yes, but isn't
now,
that very
I know
vocal?
You're frequently attacked for presenting evidence. So you just present the evidence based on your extensive knowledge, and you get under attack for that. So why bother? Why don't you just go curl up in your little science place and write papers, put out information, and just ignore the people who disparage and attack you, and just sort of do like every other climate scientist I know does, and just hide behind the the walls of the ivory tower. That'd be easy enough for you to do. So why do you bother cranking out these projections that are even scary to people? You know, I get told all the time, don't scare
people. Yeah, no, I mean, I do get attacked all the time for these. I mean, one of my favorites is when I produced a video called, Can Sea Level Rise 7 Meters by 2070? And I went through the cases to why I think, that's a very reasonable number for sea level rise compared to all of the other, ridiculous projections that are occurring. I mean, what good is a projection if you know it's going to be invalidated within 2 years or updated? And, that the Greenland ice loss and Antarctic ice loss has a doubling period of about 7 years. And if you take that doubling period, that's happened over the last 2.5 decades and projected into the future, then the 7 meters by 2070 even becomes a conservative projection, about half of it being from Greenland and half from Antarctica. So that was one of my favorites, and that got me kicked out of a lot of Facebook groups. For example, the so-called global warming fact of the day, those people who act like Nazis and disciplining people on their site. But, and other ones, and then there's the so-called methane, I call them the methane deniers. I mean, the mainstream methane people who say, yes, it's going to take hundreds of years for methane to come out. These are the same people that, a lot of these, most of these people that sit in front of computers have never been up into the Arctic, and they are the same people that said methane could not come out from the Eastern Siberian Arctic Shelf sediments. It simply could not come out until the Russian observation showed, well, it's coming out, So, the models, in a nutshell, the models are slab models, they're 2D, models, and they look at how long it takes heat to go through sediments, and of course, fractures and areas of unfrozen ground like talics and so on completely invalidate the models, as does the data. So the attack, it's interesting because, the attack is not just from deniers. In fact, the attack is much more ferocious in my experience from scientists and from the compartmentalized mainstream, in quotes, scientists, right? I thrive on this stuff. I mean, I'm a chess player, right? I try to problem solve. I try to look at patterns in systems, and I thrive on this. So any of the opposition or comments, I just shrug off. I just ignore. I do my own thing. I'm a bit of a lone wolf that way, I guess. And I always kind of have been. So, and in fact, when a problem becomes solved, that's when I would be looking for another thing to do. But, as long as there's lots of controversy and there's lots of attacks and so on, I feed into that. It gives me lots of energy. It has the opposite effect to me that it would have to most people. And I do have kids. I mean, I'm concerned about their future. So, I can say that old cliched thing, right? I would encourage people that talk about, human extinction and that talk about, we're all completely screwed and that sort of thing to actually try to go into some more details as to, okay, so if we are all going to undergo extinction, how is it going to happen? What will the science tell us? Like, are we going to suddenly lose oxygen in the atmosphere and everybody will asphyxiate? Are we going to get huge methane bursts causing global explosions of fire? Like, what are the mechanisms? Because, people can live, like, are people in a nuclear submarine, for example, that can stay submerged for 2 years under the water? Are they going to survive like an extinction of everybody else in a few years if it was to happen? Are people that live in, deep, like in Ottawa, there's a Diefenbunker. Okay, it was built during the Cold War, and it was supposed to be for Canadian political leaders to go if there was a nuclear exchange. So it's nuclear hardened. I mean, a direct hit would take it out, but anything but a direct hit, and people could live down there for years at a time. It's a museum right now, but if people are convinced that extinction is going to happen in the near term, what about pooling funds, getting backers, and setting up something where, surely people in that type of environment could survive longer. So So to just talk about extinction, it's very, you know, it's too general, I think. Like, we need to try to look at details more. And that gains credibility for saying such a thing, but it also, you know, it's very good, you know, it's very difficult, challenging sort of thought experiments, if you like, that, you know, may come to fruition. I don't know. But I just like the challenge of the controversy. I think I'd have to say that. And, you know, I did play chess seriously for many years, and so hanging out with chess players, you know, you kind of get a thick skin, I think, in terms of taking criticism from people.
Right. Yes, that's certainly true. And your experience matches mine. It's not the climate deniers who bother me. It's those who deny abrupt climate change. You know, the kind of thing that clearly is going on right now is abrupt climate change. But almost everybody, including essentially every academic scientist, claims that that's a ludicrous argument, that we're still in this notion of linear climate change. Anyway,
yes.
Our time is done. Thank you, Paul Beckwith, for spending time with us today on the Progressive Radio Network. I very much appreciate it.
Yeah, well, thank you very much, Guy.
Each week we seek out a doomer who not only goes beyond the status quo, but also provides insightful and useful information. Our doomer for this week is Benjamin the Donkey, famous writer of doomer limericks. Saturday, he wrote the following limerick titled Artifact, which he posted on the Near-Term Human Extinction Support Group page on Facebook. And the day came when more and more woe piled up until humans said, oh, because the increasing strife made the struggle for life more painful than just letting go. To be clear, we're not advocating suicide. We do have a climate change update for this week, and that includes self-reinforcing feedback loop number 42, which has emerged from the journal Geophysical Research Letters, so far only online from December 5th, comes this long quote, "While scientists believe that global warming will release methane from gas hydrates worldwide, most of the current focus has been on deposits in the Arctic. This paper estimates that from 1970 to 2013, some 4 million metric tons of methane has been released from hydrate decomposition off Washington State. That's an amount equal each year to the methane from natural gas released in the 2010 Deepwater Horizon blowout off the coast of Louisiana, and 500 times the rate at which methane is naturally released from the seafloor," end quote. And speaking of atmospheric methane, a paper in the December 10th edition of Grist points out via headline, quote, "Methane is leaking out all over the damn place thanks to the oil and gas industry," end quote. Never mind the shot at the oil and gas industry, which, of course, is supported by the demands of the world's people, especially those living with industrialized nations. Never mind the role of the government in regulating industries on behalf of the citizenry, a role long abandoned on behalf of the corporations in charge of the government. The bottom line from the article, which summarizes two recent research studies, quote, "To sum up, emissions from oil and gas wells, both those that are currently operating and those that have been abandoned, are a major issue that has been going largely unnoticed. Unfortunately, America doesn't have a system set up to monitor the wells and determine which are the major emitters. And even if we did, there's no standard policy on what to do with methane-leaking wells when we find them," end quote. Whoops, mistakes have been made. That about wraps it up this week. Make sure to like our Facebook page, NatureBats Last on the Progressive Radio Network, and join our Facebook group as well. It's NatureBats Last on PRN.FM. Feel free to post questions you'd like us to address on the show. Please continue to follow my blog, GuyMcPherson.com, for further updates, essays, and speaking tours. We'll see you on the radio next Tuesday evening. If you missed the show, make sure to find us in the archives at PRN.FM and rate us on iTunes. Until next time, remember, the dominant culture has been very clever, but in the end, nature bats last. Thanks again to all the excellent contributions this week, and to Afrazen and Rianne Farrigan for the music.